Today is Tuesday, January 5th, and you're listening to International Edition of The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, voters in Georgia will determine today who controls the U.S. Senate.
President-elect Biden won Georgia by fewer than 12,000 votes, due in large part to voters in the suburbs of Atlanta shifting from Republicans to Democrats.
Also ahead, hunger in Yemen.
7-year-old Fayed Samim weighs just over 15 pounds.
Plus, a tuna sells for $200,000 in Japan. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the southern U.S. state of Georgia, where control of the U.S. Senate is on the line in a pair of runoff elections. Incumbents Republican Senators David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler are trying to hold off Democratic challengers John Ossoff, a documentary filmmaker, and the Reverend Raphael Warnock, a pastor at a historic black church in Atlanta. President-elect Joe Biden narrowly won Georgia on November 3rd, and if both Democrats win today's vote, their party will gain control of the U.S. Senate. With that prize comes the ability to advance President-elect Joe Biden's agenda. Otherwise, Republican senators will be able to block Biden's moves. With such high stakes, the runoff in Georgia has shattered campaign spending and early voting records. Both Trump and Biden campaigned in the state yesterday. The contest's final days have been dominated by President Donald Trump's continued efforts to subvert the election results. Over the weekend, he pressured the state's Republican Secretary of State to reverse Biden's statewide victory, claiming massive fraud contrary to evidence. Last night at a campaign rally in Georgia, he again falsely claimed he won the state. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson is in Georgia and has been speaking to voters. She filed this report.
President Trump on the campaign trail Monday, once again alleging election fraud.
There's no way we lost Georgia. There's no way. That was a rigged election.
Even while telling voters here they need to head to the polls once again to re-elect Senators Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue to give Republicans control of the U.S. Senate.
Lamar Cutts is a supporter of the president in Dalton, Georgia.
I'm not going to admit I cast my ballot with some skepticism because of what happened the first time.
Supporters of the president, like Mark Heiss, say defeating Democratic challengers John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock is so important it's overcome their doubts about election fraud.
They're going to have the power, the House, the Senate. That's the most extreme power that we can have against the taxpaying person. I guess our taxes will probably go up. They're going to try to take our guns away. But it could get ugly. I mean, I'm afraid if it goes the way that the Democrats want you to believe that it could get turned ugly.
President-elect Biden won Georgia by fewer than 12,000 votes, due in large part to voters in the suburbs of Atlanta shifting from Republicans to Democrats.
By electing John and the Reverend, you'll be sending a powerful message to Congress and to the country.
Can I give you a swag bag? Thank you. And would you like?
Those close margins in this traditionally Republican state mean Democrats have to mount yet another strong effort to mobilize voters.
Just go ahead and run through the guide and I'll run you through a training.
Volunteers like Kara Allen and Sean Watkins are a big part of the Democrats' strategy for reaching out to the younger, more diverse voters who have reshaped the state in recent years.
Sean Watkins, Ossoff campaign volunteer.
I actually wasn't that much into politics like maybe 2 years ago, but because of everything going on with Trump in the country, it's really made me come out and like do things like this. And I really hope that people come out and change things for the better.
Allen says Trump's doubts about his loss in Georgia don't account for the state's demographic changes in recent years.
It's just typical Trump behavior, in my opinion. Like, of course, he's not going to take the answer so easily. And like, I feel like since Georgia has always been known as a Republican state, you know, a change happens and all of a sudden, oh, there's fraud. Like, I mean, change is always possible regardless of, like, what is going on. I think it's really genuine that it happened.
A record 3 million Georgians have already headed to the polls in early voting. If Democrats win both Senate seats Tuesday, Vice President-elect Kamala Harris would be the tie-breaking vote.
But after a close presidential election here in Georgia, many of the president's supporters, like Marlena Harper, say they will not accept that result.
If there's fraudulent and won in the presidential election, I wouldn't put him past him to for some shady stuff to happen.
That raises the prospect of the results being contested well beyond Election Day Tuesday. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Atlanta, Georgia.
Meanwhile, here in Washington, D.C., officials are bracing for potential violence as Trump supporters, including the far-right Proud Boys group, plan to hold rallies tomorrow in the U.S. Capitol. Two similar recent marches ended in brawls between Proud Boys and left-wing counter-protesters, with multiple people stabbed. In December, members of the Proud Boys attacked several historic black churches. Yesterday, police in Washington arrested a leader of the Proud Boys for his involvement in one of those attacks. Washington city officials also warned supporters of President Trump not to bring guns to protests this week. Hundreds of National Guard troops are set to deploy to keep order. Reuters' Brian Wood reports.
Washington, D.C. police say they arrested the leader of right-wing nationalists, the Proud Boys, on Monday. The group is expected to converge on the U.S. Capitol this week as part of broader pro-Trump protests. Leader Henry Enrique Tarrio was charged with destruction of property during an earlier protest, and a police statement said he was, quote, in possession of two high-capacity firearm magazines at the time of his arrest. Earlier, Tarrio said on the social media app Parler that record numbers of members would protest the U.S. presidential election starting on Wednesday, when Congress is due to certify the election results. Last week, President Donald Trump had tweeted, the big protest rally in Washington, D.C. will take place at 11 a.m. on January 6th. Stop the steal. Several rallies are planned, including one outside the Capitol building. One person briefed on the president's plans said he will speak to his supporters near the White House. On Monday, city officials warned Trump supporters not to bring guns to the protests. D.C. forbids open carry of weapons or possession of a handgun without a local license. The D.C. National Guard released a statement saying they've prepared more than 300 troops to support the city government.
That was Brian Wood of Reuters. This is VOA. Four migrants were found dead and three were treated for acute sunburn after their boat reached the Canary Islands of Tenerife Tuesday, Spanish Coast Guard said. 47 people were on the boat. The number of undocumented migrants arriving in Spain's Canary Islands was more than 8 times higher in 2020 than in 2019. The COVID-19 pandemic's impact on tourism and other industries in Africa pushed many more to embark on the dangerous journey. A court in Vietnam today sentenced three freelance journalists to between 11 and 15 years in prison. Pham Chi Dung, Nguyen Thong Thuy, and Le Hu Minh Tuan were known for their criticism of government, but the Ministry of Public Security said they were convicted of spreading anti-state propaganda at a one-day trial in Ho Chi Minh City. Reuters could not immediately reach the journalists' lawyers for comment. Vietnam's ruling Communist Party has intensified a crackdown on dissent ahead of its Congress due to be held later this week.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists say between 10 to 100 trillion microorganisms, some good and some bad, live inside our digestive systems. A new study by researchers at Oregon State University suggests that they have identified a few organisms in this collection of bacteria that could lead to possible treatments of type 2 diabetes and obesity. According to the Mayo Clinic, type 2 diabetes is a chronic condition where the body either doesn't produce enough of or resists tests the effect of the hormone insulin to maintain normal levels of glucose, a type of sugar that provides fuel for the body. After an analysis, the Oregon team found four species of gut bacteria that appeared to affect the breakdown of glucose. Two of these microbe species were found to improve, and two were found to worsen the metabolism of glucose. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Amid conflict and COVID-19 in Yemen, hunger is gripping the population. Reuters' Soraya Ali reports on one malnourished boy who is fighting for his life in the capital Sana'a.
Paralyzed and severely malnourished, 7-year-old Fayed Samim weighs just over 15 pounds. He lies curled up on a hospital bed in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, having barely survived the journey there. Raghi Mohammed is a doctor at the Al Sabeen Hospital.
We received this case yesterday. He almost passed because it took them a long time to get here because of the roadblocks. He was almost gone when he arrived, but thank God we were able to do what was necessary. And he started improving. He is suffering from cerebral palsy and severe malnutrition. We admitted him to the malnutrition ward. And even though he's still tired, he's much better than yesterday.
His family had to travel over 100 miles through checkpoints and damaged roads to get him there. Unable to afford his medication or treatment, Fayed's grandma says the family relies on donations to get him treated.
The blockade is all around us and the war as well. We couldn't find cars to bring us here. No gas, no money. We are besieged from everywhere and these diseases kill. We have sick people and we can't treat them.
Famine has never been officially declared in Yemen. But a 6-year war has left 80% of the population reliant on aid, and the UN says it's the world's largest humanitarian crisis. Aid ramped up in late 2018 after the United Nations warned of impending famine. But now, coronavirus restrictions, locusts, floods, and significant underfunding of the 2020 aid response are exacerbating hunger.
These cases have increased in recent times with the war and the blockade. People's financial situation is dire, and they aren't able to provide for their children to the extent that their kids get sick and they can't save them. And sometimes it even gets worse than this. Then someone comes and helps them out with some money. Only then can they bring their children to the hospital.
Thanks to Soraya Ali of Reuters for that report. Gulf leaders are meeting in Saudi Arabia for their annual summit on Tuesday, focused on ending the dispute between a Saudi-led bloc and Qatar. Saudi Arabia on Monday announced the reopening of land borders with Qatar after a 3.5-year spat that saw the Kingdom, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain also cut diplomatic and trade ties on Qatar. They also imposed a land, sea, and air blockade. The quartet accused Doha of, among other things, supporting terrorist groups and being too close to Iran, allegations Qatar has consistently denied. Qatar's Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani was met in the historic city of Al Ula by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Meanwhile, Washington has been pushing for a united Gulf front against Iran. David DeRoche, associate professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Security Studies here in Washington, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi.
Well, it's significant, of course. It means a great deal for Qatar, and it means a great deal for the Gulf states and their partners as we confront Iran. One of the paradoxic effects of the blockade of Qatar was that air flights were not able to transit Saudi airspace to go into Qatar. And so they had to go through Iran, which means that Iran got paid overflight fees. So, you know, the blockade was undertaken ostensibly to deny support to Iran, but it had this effect of putting over $100 million a year in the pockets of the Iranian regime. But look, it's important. There's a new administration in Washington. It's going to reassess our commitments around the world. And it's very hard to say we should be committed to a group of small states, none of which are democratic as we understand it, who can't even cooperate amongst themselves. So this is a good step forward.
The summit is held 3 weeks before confronting a radically different U.S. foreign policy towards the Gulf region, and President-elect Biden is inclined to revive the JCPOA with Iran and a possible scaling back of U.S. military presence in the Gulf. How would that impact the summit focus?
Well, it's certainly in the background. I think it lends a sense of urgency to what's going on. But I think it's a little bit of a mistake to assume that the American position will radically change. Biden wants to go back to the JCPOA, but this, you can't go back to 2016. The situation's different. Iran will not just say, okay, let's go back to where we were in 2016. They're going to ask for additional concessions. They might ask for compensation for economic damage that they've suffered due to U.S. sanctions. That's all a non-starter in the West. So there will be a reassessment, but it really is remarkable when you look at the U.S. Footprint in the Gulf and U.S. action in the Gulf and in the broader Middle East, it's pretty resistant to ideology. And a lot of the folks on the Biden team were involved in the Obama policy, which looks a lot like Trump policy in the region. So having a change of administration might concentrate the mind a little bit, might lead urgency to some needed reforms. But fundamentally, America is in the Middle East because it enhances our security interests, and our security interests don't change just because we have a different president in power.
The incoming president ran on a platform of confronting GCC states over their appalling human rights records and curbing American military support for the Saudi and Emirati intervention in Yemen. What can we expect from this summit?
Well, I think the summit will have a statement of the predations committed by the Houthis in Yemen, and it will highlight the Iranian support of it. I think that this is going to be a point of contention, and it's not an easy one. You know, the Obama administration supported the initial Saudi Emirati intervention in Yemen. As the war went on, I think a lot of the opposition to it was not so much concern about Yemen as it was opposition to a policy that Trump embraced. So it's really an anti-Trump vote. Now that Trump's gone, some of that impetus may go away, but there's still going to be a fight. And I think what the GCC states will do is make a solid statement as to what their interests are and what their concerns are in order to have a strong negotiating position going forward with the Americans.
That was David DeRoche at the Near East South Asia Center for Security Studies, speaking with my colleague Mohammed El-Shanawi. An official with Ethiopia's government-appointed Human Rights Commission has been given details about the commission's report last week that security forces killed at least 76 people and wounded 200 during protests last year following the killing of popular musician Hachalu Hundessa. The commission's senior advisor, Meskanao Mulugeta, says they concluded that the attacks amount to crimes against humanity. He spoke to VOA's James Butty.
Our investigation focused on 40 localities in Oromia region, selected based on preliminary assessment of where the violence occurred following the killing of artist Hachalu Hundessa. We have talked to victims, witnesses, and authorities in these areas and collected data from hospitals and other relevant authorities. The unrest lasted for about 3 days, from June 29th to July the 2nd. So totally 123 people were killed, 500 people were injured. The first major finding on this report is about the commission of crimes against humanity. We found that the overall conduct carried out by the attackers, who were organized in groups, is not a simple act of a crime. We did find out that it's a crimes against humanity, which is an atrocity crime and a grave violation of human rights, partly because it was a widespread and systemic attack against civilian population that extended to at least the 40 places that we visited. Many of the targets in the attacks were selected on the basis of ethnic and religious identity. So because of that, we believe that crimes against humanity were committed. The other major finding is about the conduct of security forces. In some of the localities, security forces had appropriate preparedness to stop, but we still believe that the lack of preparedness on the part of the regional government to prevent such attacks, including in those localities where similar attacks have taken place before, have exposed people to a repetitive cycle of violence and abuse.
You say in your report that Ethiopian security forces killed 76 people and wounded 200 during the protest last year. Did you share your report or your findings with the Ethiopian government? And what was its response?
Yes, we have shared our report with the federal government, in the federal parliament, in the Oromia regional government and the regional council, and all relevant government institutions that we have forwarded recommendations. We also expect everyone will take public notice of the report. There has not been a formal reaction yet, but we definitely will have a discussion with them and will definitely follow up on the recommendations, the implementations of our recommendations. We believe that's why we're here, as a constitutionally mandated independent national human rights institution.
One of the key words I see throughout your report is that of attackers. Who were these attackers and were they ethnic based?
As indicated in the report, many of the attackers were groups of people who started coming out in the streets of many of these towns in Oromia region to express their griefs on the death of the artist, which later on degenerated into attacks and protests. In some areas, people traveled to nearby towns to join the attacks, but in some areas, victims and witnesses have identified them as residents of the areas. Majority of the victims, as again indicated in the report, were either ethnically or religiously targeted.
You said your commission has found that crimes against humanity were committed by individuals and groups. That's a serious charge. What is your recommendation?
Yes, it's a serious crime, an atrocity crime, and really worrying for the country and its people. That's why we've made a list of recommendations. First is around accountability, where we said those responsible for the commission must be brought to justice with due regard to their due process rights. There should not be impunity to atrocity crimes such as this one, and government needs to identify and hold accountable the perpetrators of the human rights violations that occurred during the widespread security crisis, and to regularly update the public on the process. Second is around recognizing the risk of atrocity crimes in this country. We have recommended for the government to come up with a comprehensive atrocity crime prevention strategy in line with the prevention tool recommended by the UN. We have also called for legal and institutional responses to protect minorities. The third is around victims' redress. We have made recommendation for appropriate compensation and rehabilitation of those who have suffered physical, mental, and material injury. We have also asked for the establishment of victims' fund that would allow for a harmonized and sufficient compensation for victims of human rights violation as per international human rights standards.
That was Meskana Mulageta, senior advisor to Ethiopia's government-appointed Human Rights Commission, speaking to VOA's James Butte. Would you pay over $200,000 for a fish? That's how much this year's top tuna cost today at the annual New Year's tuna auction at Tokyo's biggest fish market. But as Lucy Fielder of Reuters reports, this year's tuna actually sold for a lower price than previous years.
Tokyo's largest fish market, Toyosu, rings in the new year with its first tuna auction of 2021. But the coronavirus pandemic has slashed tuna prices because people aren't eating out. According to staff, the priciest bluefin tuna sold at 20.8 million yen on Tuesday, or just over $200,000. That's just 10% of the biggest seller of 2020, a bluefin that went for nearly $1.9 million. It's not the first sign the pandemic has hit the tuna market. Japan's tuna imports fell 18% in the first 6 months of 2020 from a year earlier, the finance ministry reported. One major bidder, Kiyomura Corp, which owns a number of popular restaurant chains, said it decided to refrain from bidding high this year. That's because top bids for prized tuna tend to create a media buzz and could encourage diners to flock to their restaurants despite the COVID risks.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters, and that's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer Nadia Taha and our managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. For more breaking and in-depth coverage of latest world events, please visit voanews.com. Chinadu 04 will be back hosting tomorrow. And until next time, stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.